Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Barry and Kathy Beck, and they'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing and photographing the world. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Barry and Kathy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Barry and Kathy Beck about fly fishing and photographing the world. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Barry and Kathy, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Barry and Kathy's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Barry and Kathy's book, Fly Waters Near and Far. And this is courtesy of Stackpole Books. If you'd like to know more about the books that Stackpole has, go to www.stackpolebooks.com. So thanks to them, we'll be giving away a beautiful coffee table book produced by Kathy and Barry, and I know the winner will enjoy it. Now, here's what you have to do to win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something we talked about during the show. You must be the first person to submit your answer along with your name and location. And you can use that text box on our homepage to submit your answer. So just listen closely and use your best typing skills and be the first one and you'll win that book. Our guests tonight are Barry and Kathy Beck. Barry and Kathy Beck need no introduction to the fly fishing industry. They are often referred to as the first couple of fly fishing. They are on the pro staffs of such companies as Sage Rod Company, Reddington, Rio Fly Lines, and Tibor Reels. As trip hosts for Frontiers International, they travel to such destinations as New Zealand, Africa, Argentina, Alaska, Bahamas, Mexico, Belize, Venezuela, Mongolia, Russia, and American West, which gives them the opportunity to photograph in a wide range of countries and environments. As photographers, their work appears regularly in sporting calendars and magazines, including Fly Fisherman, Fly Fishing in Salt Waters, Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, Gray Sporting Journal, Big Sky Journal, Montana Outdoors, and others. The commercial and clients include Patagonia, L.L. Bean, Sage Rod Company, and 3M Scientific Anglers. They have provided photography for books for numerous authors and have written and photographed for their own books, which include Fly Waters Near and Far, Kathy Beck's Fly Fishing Handbook, Seasons for the Bighorn, Outdoor Photographer's Handbook, and Fly Fishing the Flats. The Becks spend their lives in pursuit of fish and photographic opportunities. Kathy Beck has a fly fishing school in Benton, Pennsylvania, and has been teaching fly fishing for 25 years. Barry has spent his life in the fly fishing business and in photography. They regularly appear at sports shows and sporting events around the country, giving casting demonstrations and presentations on fly fishing and photography. Well, Barry and Kathy, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you. You're making me tired just listening to you talk about us.
Well, you should be after traveling all over the world like that and fishing and photography. And sounds like a big job to me. I don't know how much fun it really is. Is it fun still?
It's a lot of fun.
Good, good. Well, tell us how you got started traveling and photographing around the world and with the fly fishing.
Well, as you said, Roger, I grew up in the fly fishing industry. My parents had a tackle shop for 44 years, which we ultimately turned into a fly shop, and Kathy and I eventually bought it. And one thing led to another, from a guide service to trying a few hosted trips in Alaska, and then the hosting went on from there. But the photography side of it, I've always had a camera. I've always been fascinated by photography, and I sold my first cover when I was 16 years old, and I thought, wow, this is easy. I didn't sell another cover for another 7 years.
Sometimes it happens that way.
It does.
Yeah. So let's talk about travel a little bit. I know, you know, our title of our show and description was about travel and photography, and I want to hear a few things about the travel parts of things, because you've had so much experience, and then we'll dig into photography, because we've got just, again, a ton of questions from our listeners, and we're going to try to answer as many of them as we can. I think we may have more than we can get to, but we'll give it a good shot. But as far as the travel, now, you host many trips a year. What tips can you give fly fishers on selecting a company to book with if they want to do one of these exotic destination trips?
I'll take this one. We do 12 destinations a year for Frontiers, and I think some of the most important things to consider when you're selecting a travel agency is that on a hosted trip, it doesn't cost any more money to go with a host than it does to go by yourself. And most of the time, we've been to all of these destinations beforehand, and sometimes many times before, so we're familiar with it. We're familiar with the routine to get there, the flights, the transfers, the airports, the cities, the hotels, and we're familiar with how the week or the trip is going to go once we get to our destination. And as far as picking an agency to work with, some of it's rather obvious. You'd certainly want to pick an agency that is reputable, somebody that's been around a while. And today on the Internet, everybody's pretty transparent, so it's pretty easy to find out what people think about them. And I think to pick up the phone and talk to them. We live in an age of email and texting, but there's sometimes nothing like speaking to somebody on the phone. You can get a pretty good feel on how knowledgeable they are and how well informed they are at helping you prepare for a trip. And I guess the last thing that comes to mind is that I like to have somebody pick up the phone at any time of the day and night back home at the travel agency that we use. And that's one of the things that I've always thought was great about Frontiers, that you can be in a different time zone, and if your airline goes on strike, you can pick up the phone and call Frontiers and somebody will answer, a person will answer. You won't get a recording that says, you know, call back after 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So, I mean, they're the things that come to mind first for me.
And when you, I would imagine, too, I often think, you know, when you, and maybe you can address this because my next question was, what's the difference between a hosted and non-hosted? Because we kind of have the hosted, and then we have kind of have a destination that may have just, it may kind of be a resort or camp of some sort with guides. And then, of course, the do-it-yourself, and we won't, you know, that's a whole other show. But what, you know, it seems to me one difference comes to mind is that you've been there and you've been with the guide, so you kind of have somewhat of an objective viewpoint on how that will be. Because a lot of these places you're talking to a salesperson, I expect, and you get the sales spiel, but what's it really like being in the boat, for instance?
Yeah, and, I mean, doing it on your own is one thing. We all like to do things on our own. But so many times our fishing time is limited and it's valuable, and we just want to be able to go someplace and have all the details taken care of and not be faced with having to, you know, figure out a lot of things on our own. We just want to make sure everything's already set up and it's going to go smoothly, and all we have to do is just show up and enjoy the fishing trip.
And as hosts, you and Barry as hosts, when you're actually at the destination, I know in preparation for it, I'm sure you give great support for, you know, the people that are, you know, joining you in the group. But are you actually out on the water with them? Are you fishing? Are you kind of
It depends. If somebody's having trouble with their double haul or their casting or for whatever reason, then Barry and I will oftentimes split up, and one of us will go with somebody that wants to fish with us or somebody that needs some help in casting. If you're going with your fishing partner and you fish together and you're happy fishing with each other and don't have any problems, then the last we want to do is change that. So when there's a need, sure, we're happy to jump in and help with anything we can.
Great, great. Now, what are some of your favorite destinations that you've enjoyed over the years that you go back to?
That's a hard one. We have that question all the time. You know, I've had the question oftentimes in audiences where somebody stands up and says, if God would let you choose one destination to go to one more, where would it be? And I said, I hope he wouldn't do that to me. But
nice guy. Huh?
You know, there's just so many good places to go. And there are very, very few over 30 years of traveling places that we've gone to that I wouldn't want to go back to. I guess if push came to shove on the cold water, it would have to be New Zealand because of, you know, sometimes the technical fishing that exists there we really enjoy. On the saltwater side, anywhere up and down Yucatan is just fine, you know, easy to get to, a lot of different species to fish for. I don't know. It's hard to say you really have a favorite, but New Zealand always sticks in my side. I always have to go back. It has that magnetic quality. It just draws you back.
What about a place that you haven't been that you'd like to go? I know there might not be too many places, but I bet you there's some place you'd like to go.
Yeah, actually Bolivia, and it's on the radar for next year.
Ah. You know,
all that golden Dorado fishing is going on, and we've not done that yet, and that's certainly a priority right now. So we actually are just setting some dates up this week, and we're going to take a couple groups and go find out what it's all about.
Great, great. And then people are always, of course, cross-conscious, especially in today's world, it seems like, and so I want to ask you about, you know, what are, like, the top value destinations for today? If a person, you know, couldn't go all out and spend $10,000 a week, where's the value out there now?
I was just talking about that to somebody today, and I think the best values right now would be fairly close to home, Mexico, Belize, maybe the Bahamas, the American West. I think we'd start right there.
Yeah. I mean, does that have more to do with the airfare or the, you know, what the market is like there locally as far as a dollar exchange?
Definitely the airfare, but some of the saltwater lodges have just always been consistently less than some of the other more exotic destinations.
What do you mean by saltwater lodges?
Well, in the countries that I mentioned, Mexico, you know, the lodges that are easy to get in and out of and easy for us from here in the United States to get to.
Okay.
Roger, if you are willing to take the risk, some of those saltwater destinations that Kathy's thinking of in the Yucatan from Mexico down through Belize, they'll often put some really discounted prices out if you're willing to go in the fall, which might be obviously hurricane season, but if you can get a week of good weather, you can get some unbelievable buys and have some fantastic fishing from October into December.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know I've seen, I think Wild on the Fly used to have a website, I'm not sure if they still have it, where they had kind of last-minute specials.
Exactly. Sometimes you can find a spot like that, you bet.
Call around and say, hey, you know, can you give me a deal for if I can come next week or something? And they'd rather fill the bed in a boat than not.
Right? Exactly. They want to fill those bed nights, that's for sure. And getting something is oftentimes better than getting nothing. So, but you have to be flexible and you have to be able to do those kind of things.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so a big question about travel is always, you know, how do you pack for these things? And you guys are packing for two projects, fly fishing, you know, and then photography. And then, of course, you know, even though it's the tropics, you still got to bring your clothes in there somewhere. So,
well, in many cases, it's called paying overweight.
Oh, paying overweight. Okay.
For Kathy and I, quite honestly, as trip hosts, because we work for the Sage Rod Company, we carry on an average of 6 to 8 spare outfits. So if our clients, either their luggage doesn't arrive or they break rods or, you know, whatever, we've got backup equipment. I mean, we carry extra sunglasses. You name it, I think we carry extra things. So for Kathy and I, our overweight charges are often a little bit above normal. And on the camera side, I mean, we have two responsibilities, obviously. One is to our clients and making sure the trip goes well. And the other is shooting as much as we can, not just for our own stock and magazines, but for the company we work for. Frontiers has a constant thirst for images. They never have enough. They're always, you know, sending flyers out, new brochures, websites, et cetera, ads. So there's always a shoot list that we have to fill. So you've got to have the right gear there. So one thing for sure that always goes on board with me are the cameras. One way or the other, Kathy will get a camera bag on and a computer bag that we can carry, you know, whatever we need to get that job done. As most destinations will have some kind of fishing gear there if we're unlucky enough to have our luggage not show up. But all these years of travel, knock on wood, maybe thanks to Delta, we've always had our luggage show up. So the next trip I take next week will probably not have any luggage. But, yeah, that we just try to cover our bases, and we do end up paying the overweight.
Okay, now that's for you guys because you have kind of an extreme situation for travel.
Right.
But and you just mentioned you try to get that computer and your cameras on board. I assume you meant in the cabin of the plane.
Exactly.
Right? Okay. So what would you recommend for, you know, the vacation fly fisher that's traveling? What should they put underneath? What should they take on top, you know, in the cabin to be, you know, best prepared?
Well, we really recommend that people check their fishing gear and try not to carry it on, because we've instilled today with TSA, there's still questions on who's going to allow you on with what. We were flying to Los Rocos, and we were flying out of Miami, and as a trip leader, Kathy and I went up to the agent at the counter and said, we've got a number of anglers here that want to carry their rods and reels on board with them. And the agent said it was fine. We could do that. When we got to the aircraft, we went to board. Senior flight attendant said she didn't want them on board. And she took them and said that she would check them, and they would arrive in Caracas with us, and they did not. So we found that checking them, we carry roller bags with hard bottoms on the bottoms. Sage has a good one. Fish Pond has another excellent one, L.L. Bean, et cetera. Almost everybody has a good roller bag. You can put your rods and reels underneath on the bottom of that and then pack your soft stuff on top. And we've been really, really lucky with our groups. And every once in a while, somebody will arrive without a bag. But most of the time, it all gets there. And then for your carry-on, we find that a lot of people are, you know, carrying a computer with them. And obviously, you carry that on board. And if you have any camera gear, that should be carried on. I never check my camera gear. I have been threatened a time or two to be thrown off an airplane because I had to get that on, even at the point of talking to a pilot and explaining that this was my airplane, this camera bag. He couldn't fly without his plane. I can't work without my cameras. And fortunately, he was considerate and helped me get the bag on board.
Why cameras? I mean, what threat would they have nowadays?
It was on a small shuttle, and they said it wouldn't fit underneath the seat.
Oh, simple as that. Huh?
And they didn't have an overhead.
Ah.
So they said it won't fit underneath the seat. You can't carry it on. I said it will. They said it wouldn't. The flight attendant escorted me off the aircraft. I asked to speak with the pilot. I got to speak, who turned out that it was a female pilot, and she was very considerate. And we got the bag did, by the way, fit. And the only person that was unhappy was the senior flight attendant that wanted to get me off the aircraft. So.
Yeah, because she got kind of shot down.
Yeah.
I don't know what he likes that. Well, good. Okay. Last question about travel, and then we'll take a quick break here. Do you recommend getting travel insurance? And does the travel insurance nowadays, does it cover your fishing gear and photography gear, or is that something you have to get under your homeowners?
Well, I think you have to read the small print. There's so many different policies out there. There's trip interruption insurance, there's medical insurance, and one policy's not going to do it all. So I would think, for most of us, we better be checking with our homeowner's insurance and then just being very, very informed about what you're buying and what it does cover and what it doesn't cover.
Right. So maybe that, the homeowner's for the photography and fly fishing gear, right? And then you probably still need trip interruption if you're worried about, you know, plane not making it or a strike or things like
that. Exactly.
And the two sides of it there. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I always, and you never know. You know, I guess with the trip interruption, you could sprain an ankle the week before, and without that, you'd be in a world of hurt trying to make that trip or something. So
yes,
I think it's good thing to have. Okay, well, we need to take a quick break here, Barry and Kathy, and then when we come back, we'll dig in more and talk about photography. So stick with me.
Okay.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Barry and Kathy Beck about fly fishing and photographing the world. If you'd like to ask Barry and Kathy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, before we dig into the photography questions that we have lined up here, Barry and Kathy, would one of you tell us what's going on in your fly fishing world and, you know, and just what's happening with you guys?
Well, here at home, we've got a new website that we're going to launch next week. The address hasn't changed. It's BarryandKathyBeck.com, the whole thing spelled out. So we're pretty excited about that, and we're launching a new blog. Let me see. We just got home from New Zealand, and we leave for Argentina in the middle of the month, so we're looking forward to that. And we've got fly casting classes coming up in the spring and some guiding here on Fishing Creek. And in between hosting our destinations throughout the year, we have to find some time to play with our grandsons.
Very important.
Very important. That's really what we'd rather do than anything else at times.
And how old is that grandson?
Oh, we've got two little boys. We've got them at 1.5 and 2.5.
And a little young for learning how to cast. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, a little. Not much. It won't be long.
Well, and we know they'll have a great teacher, Grandma, right?
Well, thank you. I hope they think so.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Yeah. Well, great, great. So, new website. We're expecting a lot of great photography on that website, right?
Yes, yes.
Good, good. That'll be fun to see, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, good, good. Good to hear you guys are keeping busy. I know you always seem to be on the move, so good for you. All right, well, let's talk about photography here. Gosh, we just got a ton of questions here, and we'll kind of pop around here. Let's first talk about equipment. There's a lot of equipment. And Stan Wright in Hawaii talks first about, you know, do you ever just use one of those little point-and-shoot cameras that fits in the shirt pocket? Does that have a use out there on the river?
Well, they always have a use. I love Stan's question because I would love to live with a little point-and-shoot camera. It would make life so simple. And, you know, honestly, we always try to have a point-and-shoot camera around. They're good for a lot of things. I mean, your Facebook page, things like that, web stuff. My problem with point-and-shoot has always been the format itself. I really like a raw format because then I can do a little bit more with it. Editors are happy with it. And there hasn't been much around, but Nikon just came out recently with a P7000, which is a 10-megapixel point-and-shoot. I immediately bought one. And I've fallen in love with it. I can do a lot more with it than I anticipated, and it does fit a little awkward at times, but in a shirt pocket. So I'm pretty excited about that. A lot of the people that travel with us carry the little waterproof Olympus or the Pentax, and they get some great stuff with them. I'm amazed at what they can shoot underneath, underneath the water. But for us, because most of our work is commercial, I really prefer a raw image. So I was so excited to see this cool fix finally show up. And I think, you know, the technology just keeps evolving, and Who knows what's ahead? Every time I turn around, whatever I bought is being replaced by something else.
Yeah, you can't win in well, it used to be you can't win in computers, you still can't, but now since they've migrated into the cameras, you know, you can't win either. And it does seem, though, once you get into the SLRs, that at least many times you can keep the lenses and maybe be just buying new bodies, which is somewhat helpful in the pocketbook, I think.
Exactly. That's been one of the good things about Nikon for me. I mean, I grew up with Nikon, and it's my first choice. And, you know, even some of my older lenses I can still use today. So that's a big plus.
Yeah, and those are the real pricey parts of the camera, where the,
exactly,
the lens cost is much or more than the camera sometimes. But
you're right.
Frank kind of wondered about the same thing. He says he's assuming you use digital SLRs for your work, and you know, you've kind of alluded to that. And then he asked specifically about pocket cameras. Are there any that, and maybe this Coolpix you're just talking about, that will accept polarizing filters?
It does not. I wish it did.
Yeah.
That's hard to find in a point-and-shoot camera. I saw an ad one time for filters for point-and-shoot cameras, but I've not saw the point-and-shoot camera that you can put it on. I don't know.
So a little bit difficult, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you do use a lot of polarizing.
It's the only filter that Kathy and I use.
Really?
We have the circular polarizer. I used to insist upon a warming polarizer. A long, long time ago, I had a pair of they were Action Optics sunglasses, and they were a sort of a copper-colored lens. And every time I looked through those lenses, I thought, gosh, if I could create a photograph that looks as good as what I'm seeing right now. I couldn't find a filter like that, so we sent the sunglasses to Germany. And for $500, we had a circular warming polarizer made, and I just loved it. I was shooting film at the time. Kathy and I shot a lot of Velvia. And I just thought it just popped that Velvia even a little bit more. I just loved what I was seeing. But I carried that into digital, and I've realized that, quite honestly, that a good friend of mine told me this, and I don't know why I didn't think about it. You can use a gray polarizer and set your white balance to cloudy, which is what really gives you a warming effect in your images, and you now have a warming polarizer. So, pretty easy.
What about adding that warmth just in Photoshop later?
Oh, you can do that, but you know, you'll probably be surprised at this, and our listeners probably will as well. I don't own Photoshop.
You know,
I'm an editor. Yeah, we'll talk about that in some of these questions I'm sure we're going to hear.
Okay.
And I'll explain in detail why I don't, but I don't use it.
So, okay. Now you're going to have to go there now, Barry.
All right, we'll go there now. I'm going to get ahead of the game here.
You got first, my interest on.
Yeah, first off, I'm an editorial. Kathy and I are editorial photographers. We're not fine art photographers. And I ingest my images. We download all our images in a very simple program called Photo Mechanics. It allows us to keyword and to catalog the images and put them in folders. And after that, we use Nikon Capture NX, which is a similar program to Photoshop, but it allows us to do anything we need to do to just tweak an image a little bit to get our art director's attention. But art directors are Photoshop maniacs. They can really do whatever they want. And I've learned a long time ago, if I can shoot it and we can get it out of the camera as good as we can with limited amount of fixing here in the office, they'll take it from there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't sharpen in the camera. We sharpen in the computer, but not over-sharpening is a very important thing to do with art directors. They'll take care of it from that point on. But, no, that's it. I've never had a Photoshop class. I've never used one. This Capture NX does everything we need it to do to get that raw image to our art directors, and they'll be happy.
You know what it sounds, for me, having a background in photography as well, it sounds like you're shooting digital like you shot film.
In other words, exactly.
You have to get it on film or it's not there. And so you're spending the time up front getting the shot rather than time on the back end getting the shot.
And Roger, and we're 45 weeks a year on the road. And, you know, with film, we used to have a week or two to get the work to the editor, the magazine, or the client. I mean, they want it within hours today.
Wow.
You know, sometimes.
And you can do that, though, with the internet.
Exactly. They've got an FTP site. We can get the stuff to them and they'll take it from there. If you give them a raw image that looks good, any way they want it fixed, cropped, or whatever, they'll do it.
Right. And just for those maybe just entering the digital world with photography or getting started, could you explain when you're talking about raw, what that means? I mean, okay. In simple terms, the different options that you have.
Yeah, well, actually, it's how the image is compressed. With a raw image, there's a lot more information for an art director to work with. Unfortunately, that takes up more room on a memory card, and it takes up more room on your hard drive. But it's what he needs to really work with the image and be able to crop or change this or that. The smaller the JPEG, the less he can do with it. And if you really want to blow something up, like we just recently sold an image to from our stock agency in Maine, Aurora, and this is not fly fishing, although it was shot on a fly fishing trip. There was a little boy eating a bull cereal on a lodge porch, and I photographed him, and I've got a photo release from his parents, and I sent it off to our stock agency, and it's on a billboard right now.
Mm.
If that were a JPEG, just wouldn't be enough information there. The file size wouldn't be large enough for the advertiser to really make the image as large and as sharp as they would want to have it. So while JPEGs are fine to share things with and make small prints with and use for, you know, web photos, etc., if you really get into the magazine work or you get into larger printing, 16 by 20s or larger, you really want to shoot raw. You can just do a whole lot more with it.
Yeah, and that's a setting that the camera may have. I mean, on most cameras you can go in and say what file
exactly
type you want to use, and that's one of the options.
Right, on SLRs, but there's only a few point-and-shoots that offer raw. Canon has one, Nikon has one, and there's another new point-and-shoot out, and I'm trying to think what it is. I think it's a Lumix Panasonic, one of the Panasonic shoots raw. So there's some choices out there
right. In
point-and-shoot, but we have to shoot raw. Now, what I should go back a step here. The first thing we'll do is somebody's looking for an image. We get a query from a magazine, and they need a shot of somebody holding a bonefish. We'll probably FTP them or send them maybe a dozen good of our best shots in a JPEG format so they can quickly open them up and look at them.
Mm-hmm.
If they like what they see, then they'll request a RAW file, which will then follow.
Okay. Good. Stan, who asked our first question on equipment, he's in Hawaii. He says, I'm guessing you have a zoom lens. What do you figure you do the most shooting at? Wide, normal, telephoto? And is there any ISO, ASA settings that you generally use?
Okay, well, starting with the lens, I mean, I have more lenses than Kathy and I could carry. But when it comes down to if we only had one lens, Nikon makes an 18-200. It's a DX format. It's not extremely fast, but with the high ISOs that we can shoot today, you can get some super sharp images and do a whole lot with it. When you think 18-200, that's a very long length to work with. I wouldn't go anywhere without that lens. Sometimes I'm forced to because of a weight restriction or where I'm working, that's the only lens I can take. So that's the one I travel with. I don't like to travel with just one lens. I don't like to be limited with it. And as far as, you know, which is best, wide, medium, you know, long, it depends on the environment I'm shooting in. If I'm in a flats boat, then I certainly need something that's wide enough to work around the boat. If I'm shooting a lodge bedroom for a brochure, I'd really like to have something in the 10 to 12 millimeters. On the other hand, a lot of times I'd like a very shallow depth of field to just really punctuate the person and the fish and blur that background out. So I like something a little bit longer from even 90 to 180 millimeters, if you will. Just it all depends. It depends on, you know, the final image that I'm looking for. I'd like to have, you know, one lens to just live all the time with, but that just most of the time doesn't work. But the 18-200 has saved us many, many times.
Yeah.
And on the ISO side, you know, we used to shoot film. You know, when we were shooting Velvia, it was Velvia 50, and we would push it to 80 just to get a little more, you know, speed out of it. I'm shooting at ISOs at 1600 now and finding very little digital noise in light that I never dreamed I could shoot in.
Wow.
I find most of the time I start out at an ISO of either 200 or 400, And then if I don't have enough light to work in, I'll go up that scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's just, and as you, when you reach the marginal areas, then when you say noise, that's...
we used to call it grain.
Grain, yeah. So it starts breaking up the image. Yeah.
Right.
And, wow, that's still a 200 to 400. That's a nice area to work in.
Wonderful.
Especially when you're used to, back in the 25.
Oh.
ASA, like Photochrome 25 or something like that.
Exactly.
Tough to work with.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got Bob Duncan. He says he's both an avid fly fisher and photographer, albeit a novice. He's asking, what do you normally take in the water? I guess you just answered that, didn't you? And he said filter combination. So I guess you've answered both of that, the 18 to 200 with the polarizing filter.
Right. If I'm stuck with one, but there, if somebody asked me what lenses would I like to have,
mm-hmm.
I'd carry a 10 to 24, the 18 to 200, and I also carry a 70-200 2.8 just for that 2.8 f-stop. And it seems repetitious to carry two focal lengths very similar, but that 2.8 sometimes makes a huge difference in the end result.
Especially when you're low light levels in
exactly.
the day, beginning of the day or things like that.
Exactly.
Paul Bowers in Sandy, Utah, he says, I've only dropped one camera in the river, one too many. I like your suggestions on combining quality photography with standing in the river. For some of it's not a question of when we will end up wet on top. It's not a question of if, but when we will end up wet on top. Is there recommendations when you're in the water? How do you safely, carry your gear around and move around when you're trying to stop?
Oh, boy.
Or do you hold your breath a lot and hope that next
hold
step
breath
is a
lot.
Good one?
The first thing Kathy and I learned a long time ago is what the camera strap is for. Put the thing around your neck. The first thing. So if you need your hands for something, a camera is still hanging around your neck. Keeping cameras dry, obviously the small point and shoots, the waterproof ones that we talked about are wonderful because you can stick them in your vest pocket and don't worry about them. But like this Coolpix, there's sooner or later will be a great little housing for all these cameras that are not waterproof, end up with little housings that are available for them, and they're waterproof, so you don't have to worry about them. I've seen some waterproof bags, small bags now for point-and-shoot cameras that you can stick them in. But if you're really concerned about the camera getting wet, then you definitely need to have it in something. The worst-case scenario is double Ziploc bag it and stick it in your pocket. Cover it with something. On the SLR side, Ewa Marine makes a very, very easy-to-use waterproof bag that's totally waterproof that you can put your camera in and keep it dry, although it's bulky. It's not something I'd want to try to fly fish with and carry it around my neck. It is a way to keep my camera dry when I'm out and still shoot underneath the surface if I want to. But I will be honest with you. For the most part, Kathy and I have cameras around our necks, and they are not waterproof. And every once in a while, yes, something does get wet. I wish they didn't, but they do.
And in the salt, that's kind of a problem, right?
Oh, it's always a problem. I found in the salt, we use these lightweight nylon stuff bags, and just when we're in the boat, we keep that camera in that bag at all times unless we're actually shooting. And we're both very careful to clean the cameras when we come back every night, do everything we can to keep that salt residue off it. And when we get home, we go back over the cameras again, trying to, keep them as clean as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, wet cameras are wet cameras. I'll just share a really quick funny story with you. We had a client with us in Alaska that had his wife's new point-and-shoot camera with him, and he set it in the bottom of the boat. Well, the bottom of the boat gets water in it, and it did. And when he came back at night, he was all upset, and he said, I turned my wife's camera on, it makes funny noises, nothing works. And I said, well, we'll just take everything, open anything we can on this thing, and let it dry out overnight, and let's see what happens, because it's fresh water. Maybe it'll be okay. True story, took it in and put it in a microwave and put it on the reheat or something and ruined the microwave and the camera. So they do get wet.
Yeah, because you got all that metal inside the camera.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Got my sparks flying. I can see it now.
Well, it wasn't a really smart thing to do.
Ah, Yeah. Interesting. One more thing.
Sorry to interrupt you, Roger.
No,
one more thing. You know, companies like Patagonia, I think Simms has one as well. A lot of the fly fishing manufacturers make these waterproof fanny packs, chest packs, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful to, you know, stick a point and shoot camera. In some cases, like I know the Patagonia and the Simms, I've been able to get a body and an 18 to 200 in it. And that's a good way to keep it dry while you're waiting around.
Yeah, there's also, I know I've done this on raft trips. You know, they've got some small dry bags.
In fact, I've
used clear dry, you know, they're transparent clear dry bags that you can put your stuff in, and you can see in there and grab stuff that you need.
Perfect.
Pretty quickly. And what we used to use is on the rivers, too, are ammo boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Always had an ammo box with foam in it.
Mm-hmm.
To where you could just pop the top, grab your camera, shoot, and then stick it back in and clamp down the, and then it's waterproof inside there. So
that's a good point.
That's something we used in the old days, anyway.
So. Old days.
I guess you would use a Pelican case today.
Yeah. Lots of newfangled stuff nowadays. Yeah. We need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll dig more into this photography, and we've got plenty more questions to answer. So stick with us, folks. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Barry and Kathy Beck about fly fishing and photographing the world. If you'd like to ask Barry and Kathy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's see what else we got here. So, Norm... And I don't know if this is Norm's last name is Dublin or Norm is from Dublin, Ireland. But anyway, Norm asks about what are your suggestions for an effective, compact, lightweight system of self-photography? Now, I'm not quite sure what he means by self-photography.
Yeah, I wonder if he's taking a picture of himself with the fish.
Yeah, and we have some other questions around that, too, so we might address that on what some of the options are for that.
Okay. There. Do you want to do that now, Roger?
Sure.
Okay. If you've got a wide enough lens on your point-and-shoot camera, and it takes a little balancing act here, you can reverse the camera pointing at yourself, put your finger over the shutter, hold it as far away from you as you can at your widest setting, and if the fish is holdable with one hand, you can lift the fish up very quickly up toward your face, smile, click the picture and get the fish back in, and then take a look at what you've got. I've done it a couple times. It works, providing the fish is small enough and that you can easily handle it and that the camera is wide enough to include you and the fish. It's not easy. It's much nicer to have somebody with you, to even if you can walk them through taking the shot. But sometimes it's the answer to getting some kind of a photo versus none at all.
I've got a Canon G11.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I've done with that is it has a fold-out viewfinder
mm-hmm.
on the back.
There you go.
You can flip it around, and actually you can be looking into the viewfinder as you're shooting yourself.
That's a great asset.
And I've done a number of self-portraits that way. But you got to remember, too, to not look at the viewfinder when you actually take the shot. Look at the lens, otherwise you're looking at the viewfinder. So, your eyes are just slightly off, you know.
Well, it's difficult at best, but it is doable.
Yeah.
But you put it on self-timer, but till you try to, you know, that's hard on the fish, obviously. You've got to keep him in the net or in the water somehow. Set the camera up on the bank and try to focus it and set your self-timer and run out, pick the fish up, hold it, and smile.
Right.
I've tried that a time or two with not much success.
Right. Yeah, hard to get that all. And then, meanwhile, the fish is waiting.
Right, exactly.
I want to go home.
Yeah. You know? I don't blame them for that.
Yeah, yeah. We have a couple of questions here on underwater camera housings, and I'm assuming you've done some shoots like that or
a lot.
Shots. Or, pardon me?
A lot of it.
Yeah, okay. So Kevin in Plainfield, Illinois, he says, do you use underwater camera housings? What would you advise and for, you know, doing an image of a trout underwater?
Well, with our SLRs, the Ewa marine bag that I talked about is probably the most economical and safest. There's a number of choices out there. If you Google them, you can find them, but that's a brand name that's been around a long time. A lot of scuba divers and snorkelers use them, and they're very easy to use. They even have one with a flash area on it that you can do some underwater flash, which I don't do much of. But Kathy and I have also have a couple Ike lights, which are underwater heavy-duty housings that are extremely durable, very good. But the dilemma is that every time that we buy one for a camera, the next camera that comes along, the camera doesn't fit it. And you're
right.
Talking an investment of close to $1,000. So we're now on about our fourth housing, and the last one we bought fits the D300S Nikon, which is an SLR, and that's it. As far as I'm concerned, I can do anything I want with that camera. I don't plan on upgrading as cameras get upgraded. We'll live with that for a while.
What was the brand name of the camera bags that you were talking about?
The Ewa Marine. It's EWA-MARINE. They're very packable. They're very, very easy to use, and they're safe.
Okay.
I had a good friend show up with a bag that was similar, sort of a knockoff, and it was made in Korea. And in very broken English, I had to laugh when I read the instructions. It sort of said, if you put this bag in the water and you see water coming in the bag, pull out immediately. I thought that was pretty simple.
Yeah, that gives you a lot of confidence.
Yeah, well, the thing I always watch for, we both watch, is air bubbles. You know, when you submerge it, you're going to get a few immediate air bubbles. But if the air bubbles continue, then you absolutely have to get that thing back out of the water because you've got a leak.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good tip. You talked, Mark Brown talks about, he's in Perth, Western Australia, and you did talk about point-and-shoot cameras earlier, but he says, are there any that are particularly good in low light? He says he has a Lumix DMC LX3.
Right.
Very nice camera, but camera fast lens, but not as good in low light as he would have expected.
He's right.
Okay.
In fact, right now there's a review in one of the camera magazines on Canon, the Lumix, and the Nikon, and all these new point and shoots. It's an American Photo. And he can find that and read it, and he'll find that, you know, they're making great strides, but they aren't there yet in that situation. Ultimately, they will be. And these things just, like I said, you know, they just keep evolving and they get better and better.
Yeah. So then your answer is a tripod.
The answer is the tripod.
Yeah, the old standby. Frank, we've got some photographers out here, Barry. Frank in B.C. asks again, said he purchased a Nikon D90 body, not realizing it doesn't have seals for the battery compartment. Is there amateur camera bodies with seals, and if so, who makes it? And I'm assuming he wants seals for moisture reduction, I guess, in the battery compartment. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, the replacement to the D90, Frank may have just should have waited maybe just a little bit longer. Like I said, these things keep just getting better and better. Their new camera, the replacement for the D90, is the D7000. And that has a pretty well-sealed body. It's coming as close to getting to the pro models as you're going to get out of a company like Nikon. But that said, I've got a lot of clients. Kathy and I have a lot of clients that travel with us that shoot D90s. And I've got a husband and wife that do a lot of trips with us. They're both good photographers. They both have D90s, and they beat those things around with everything else we carry. And they've really had no problems with them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I wouldn't worry too much about it. I wouldn't take it out in the pouring down rain and keep it out there for a little bit. But I think if you get a little water splash on it, I don't think he has to worry too much.
Okay. He had a couple other questions. He says, please explain how you back up your digital files when you're on a trip.
Okay, I'll take that one. That's
sure.
usually my job. when we get back to the room at night, we download our cards to the hard drives on our computers. And then we do a quick edit. We just cut out anything that we know we don't want, delete anything that we want to discard. And then we copy that to a DVD. And after we get home, we copy those images to the network. We never, we travel with lots of cards. So there are times when we don't need to reformat our cards. We just leave those images sit right on the card until we need the card. And then if we have to reformat to shoot to fill it up again, we do. But as long as those images can sit on that card, that's where they stay. And they're backed up on the DVD, and they're also on the hard drive in the computer.
Right,
and then when we get home, we move those images to our network here in the office. We have a rack of Buffalo Terra stations. So we move all of our images to the Buffaloes. The DVDs that we made while we were away go right to the bank in a safe deposit box, and that is our off-site storage. Rather elementary, but it works for us.
Perfect.
And then we reformat all the cards, and we work off the network drives here in the office.
Okay. Now, when you say Buffaloes, what you want to explain to everybody what you mean by that?
A Buffalo is just a brand name. It's a Terra station. It's a random draw. It's a RAID system inside the Terra station, which means that it's very safe. If it starts to see a malfunction or an error happening, it automatically backs up itself. And they just hold a lot of inventory. And I think we've got four stacked up right here in the office now.
So it sounds like what you're talking about is just hard drives that are mirrored. So that one goes down, the other one has the information. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so lots of redundancy. Good for you guys.
Lots and lots of redundancy.
Can't get those shots again sometimes, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, no, it sounds like a very a doable thing you can do on the road with the laptop and the DVD burning and all that.
Yeah, and actually, to take that a step further, our office manager has a matching set of these Buffalo, of these mega hard drive storage units at her house. And once a week, she brings them all back in, and we do a backup. So any submissions to magazines or images that have that we've worked on or images that we've keyworded so that we have a complete backup of our most current in-house work, we also back up the Terra stations.
Wow. Good for you. Okay. Food for thought for everybody that doesn't believe in backups, how important it is.
Yes.
Especially when your whole business relies on it, you know. So, very important. Another question, we're kind of jumping back here on a tropical area, but Frank up in BC also asked about how do you maintain your SLR when fishing in a tropical environment. You already mentioned you do a cleanup afterwards. Anything else you do?
Absolutely, and I would appreciate Frank asking that question because one of the things you really have to be aware of in a tropical environment is that most lodges have air-conditioned rooms. So if you take your camera in, and out of this heat and humidity that's been in, and you walk into an air-conditioned room, and the next morning you take that cold air-conditioned camera back out in that heat, your camera's immediately going to fog. Your lens fogs, the body fogs, and you really, really don't want that moisture in there. So what Kathy and I do to keep the camera safe, we store our camera bags in the bathroom and keep the bathroom door shut. And we don't turn the air conditioner way up. It would be nice to have it way up, but we can't have those cameras getting cold and having all that condensation build up. So unless you're at a lodge where you trust the office manager to keep your bag somewhere off-site where it's not air-conditioned, you really have to beware.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happens so quickly, and you can run into all kinds of problems.
Okay, if you do have that happen, it does fog up, what do you do?
Well, you take it out in the light, and I take the lens off, open the camera body up, which I don't like to do in a saltwater environment, but I try to get just let the airflow go through, and eventually it will defog itself. But just having all that moisture, keep in mind your camera's sort of a mini computer, you really don't want that moisture inside that camera body at all. So I try to keep the camera in an area where we're not going to have to worry about the air conditioner.
Now, did you say, you may have mentioned this before, but I just saw a question come in on the internet, Adam in Tabernash. He says, what kind of camera do you use? You may have mentioned this earlier, but I can't remember if you did. What you use a Nikon for the SLR, a Nikon?
Yes,
what?
All our cameras are Nikon. I've been pretty loyal to the brand because they've been very good for us. I mean, there are a lot of Canon shooters. I mean, we're seeing Panasonic cameras come around, and Sony's got some fantastic stuff out there. But I bought my first Nikon when I was 16 years old, and I've been, I find that if you stay loyal to one brand, you know how it works. You know how the lenses have become interchangeable through the years with different camera bodies, and the repair department has done wonderful things for us. So, and it was Nikon that truly got us into digital. It was just a chance meeting. Kathy was doing a casting demonstration at Bob Marriott's Fly Fair, and Lefty Cray and I were standing there watching her, and this guy comes up, and he said, so you guys are still shooting film? And we just looked at him and thought, what are you talking about? And we said, sure, we're shooting film. What else is there? And this guy said, well, there's digital. And we said, nah, digital will never be as good as film. He said, you guys are dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And the guy's name was Ron Taniwaki. He works with Nikon. He's become one of my dearest friends and switched us on to digital early. And thank goodness for it. But
yeah. It's come a long way.
It's been a good brand that we're happy with.
Yeah. Frank also asked about the use of tripods. We mentioned this a minute ago, and he says, are there any particular ones that work better in tropical environment? And I would say in water.
Yeah.
At that.
Well, the carbon fiber, have been my favorites, and Kathy's as well because of the weight factor. But we use a monopod probably more than we use a tripod. And that's only when I've got a longer lens on. With the image stabilization, these vibration reduction, they give them all kinds of names on these lenses and the higher ISOs, we can get some awfully sharp images without a tripod, even in low light, by bumping that ISO up. But if it's critical, I'll find something to set the camera on or brace it against or things like that, because carrying the Gipsos that we have, they're still, even though they're carbon fiber, there's, a weight factor. And, as I said before, we pay a lot of weight and overweight charges. So if I have to have a tripod, if I know I'm going to use it, I'll take it. But 99% of our shooting is handheld.
And if you're going to use a monopod, is it a Gitzo monopod that you're
using? It is. It's a Gitzo monopod. I found a really nice head for it I like. I've used it in Africa last year, and I loved it. It's made by Really Right Stuff. You can find those people on the internet. They make some fantastic things, and it's just a wonderful ball head kind of thing that goes on this Gitzo monopod, which is relatively light. So, and I've shot my biggest lens. The biggest lens that Kathy and I own is a Nikon 200-400, and it is a pretty big lens. And I can put that thing on this monopod and shoot at 400 ISOs, and I've got some shots of a cheetah chasing a rabbit down in Africa that's just razor sharp. You can count the hairs on his nose.
What about gorillapods? Do you find use for those?
I don't use them.
Okay.
But I know people that do and like them. I try to stay as clean as I can, carry as little as I can, and I still find I take too much.
Yeah, kind of like backpacking for me.
Yeah.
Yep. I say, okay, now what can I leave at home next time?
Yeah, our camera bags are backpacks, and we get asked that question a lot. We use Tamrac Extremes. I have one bag that Kathy and I think we've flown a million miles with it. It looks like it. The gentleman in the airport in Auckland asked me, he said, where has that bag been? And I said, just about anywhere you can think.
Wow.
But the backpack leaves you free. I use a chest kit to fish out of, backpack on my back with cameras. Kathy carries a fish pond pack with a chest kit on the front and a backpack on the back that she can carry extra things, like we carry extra color hats and different colored clothing so we can use for props. You can't go in every shop to look the same, clothing
right,
colors,
right.
Things like that. And she carries some covers and some odd stuff for, that we shoot with, but we both end up with backpacks.
And it you end up being each other's models, I take it, in many cases, right?
Well, yeah, to a point. We're always looking for that new face.
Come on now. Kathy's very pretty now.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, Kathy has been on close to 100 covers over the years all over the world, and you need the diversity as, you know, part of the success of the business. And
well,
we're always happy to...
I expect those two grandsons will be ending up on some covers.
Well, I hope so. They're both great-looking kids. And you know what? The oldest one, Bridger, knows how to say cheese, and he just got his first digital kid's camera. So
they're destined for a certain future.
I hope so.
Yeah. We need to take another quick break, and then we'll spend the rest of our time talking about getting some really good shots. So hang in tight with us, folks. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or you can call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Barry and Kathy Beck about fly fishing and photographing the world. Sorry about that. If you'd like to ask Barry and Kathy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question, and we'll try to answer as many as possible tonight. Okay. Barry and Kathy, let's see here. We're running short on time. We want to make sure we get to most of these. And I'm going to cut Harold's comments and questions rather short, but basically Harold, he's out in Westchester, New York, talks about the progression of fly fishing photography and film, and he says the bar has really been raised high. There's some stunning stuff, and he credits you two for raising that bar over the years. And he asks, you know, what is your opinion when you go out and go to fish and film? What is your stance on what you have to produce? Now, I remember you saying earlier you had a shot list that you're always trying to fill. Does that play a role in what Harold's asking here? Or
it plays a major role for Kathy and I. I think where Harold's coming from is, do I fish or do I photograph? What's the most important? But for us, because we've got to come home with the images, obviously that plays a priority. So sometimes I'm shooting when I would really like to be fishing. But it's a hard decision to make sometimes if you're just having this as your hobby. But it's our livelihood, so, you know, oftentimes, and we're always honest with these things, sometimes you have to do setup shots. So it takes a while to set this thing up and shoot it. And meanwhile, there could be the best hatch in the world going on with fish rising, but, you know, we need to get the image. So that's
light's right.
That's exactly, the light's right. And, you know, unfortunately, it seems when the light's right is when the fishing's right. So
yeah.
It's just part of it.
And, yeah.
And we love both sides of that coin. I'm just as happy with the camera as I am with the fly rod.
Sure. And Lance asks, you know, do you take turns fishing and shooting?
We do.
Okay.
We have to. Yeah. You know. And that was funny. And it's a good thing to do because, you know, Kathy's perspective sometimes is quite different than mine. And I know many times I've come back from a shoot and, you know, she shot a card or two. I've shot 20 cards. And when it comes down to the final edit, there's this one or two images that stick out, and they're hers.
Yeah.
And it's good to do that, you know, because you look at things a little differently.
Yeah, I noticed that an old friend of mine and I, he's a photographer too, and that's my background way back when, and we were up in Breckenridge, Colorado, last summer, and we were both just walking through the village, you know, and shooting things here and there. And he would he took a couple shots that day that I just kind of like, I don't see a shot there, you know.
Yep, exactly.
But later on when we got back and he showed me what he had done, I go, wow, I didn't see that. I just didn't see that. And he did, you know. So I'm sure, yeah, you guys do the same kind of thing.
And it's one of the best things about digital, because you get back, and I always tell people, you know, you've got that delete button on your camera, but be very careful before you push it, because when you get back and actually look at it on a screen and enlarge the image a little bit, you might see something you just simply didn't see in your monitor on the camera. So, you know, be careful, because it may be something that you really, really like, and it may be something that even if you don't like it so much, you might be able to fix it and make it something you like. So I'm always reluctant to push that the button on the camera. I'm not reluctant to do it on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
When we do our edits, we do a hard edit. I mean, it's got to be good or it doesn't stay.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just takes up hard drive space.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some specific questions about getting good shots. What's the best time of day to get the best shots?
Well, you know, I often think that there are three ingredients in a good image, and, you know, it's light, certainly light and composition play a major role, but I think the third one's the most important, and that's, you know, capture the action when it's happening, when you see it. So I don't say anymore that there's the perfect time. You know, if something happens and it should, you know, you should take the picture, you should take it, because the light may change, anything may change, the whole thing, situation goes. But I really like most photographers, I like that magic light of early morning and late afternoon. But I found with digital, I can shoot more into the morning and earlier in the afternoon. You know, you've got more latitude, which is, it's just quite wonderful. And where I used to dread bad light, I now think it sometimes enhances our images. And they find that Kathy and I are shooting in light that we never dreamed we would be shooting in. And on gray, really ugly days when I used to struggle with warming filters and doing whatever I could to enhance the light, you know, today I've got a chance to actually adjust my own white balance. We can, you know, use a cloudy white balance or open trade and enhance those images and make them look wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our shooting hours have truly expanded with digital.
And what about, you mentioned composition, what tips can you give folks that you know, are not professional photographers, but, you know, what makes a shot better as far as composition?
Well, anything that draws the viewer's eye to what you want them to see, to the subject. I try to, most of our shots, we don't try to put anybody in the center of the frame on a horizontal. A little bit left or right, that's pretty elementary photography. I try not to, try to give an editor a lot of extra room if they want to crop. I look for images that are spontaneous with people with excitement in their eyes. I really like, for a long, long time, I still do admire all the geographic photographers. They can capture the emotion of the moment. I really like to do that. I like the image to look exactly as I see it. I really try to push the point where, you know, don't think in a horizontal world. Shoot horizontal and vertical images and move around a lot. You know, don't get stagnant and just stand in one place. Get down low, move up, move right. Get a stepladder. Get up on a shelf. Do anything you can to change your angles and look at what you see in your viewfinder and shoot, because it's digital. Not like film. You don't have to worry about throwing the slides away. You just push a button and it's gone when you get back in the computer. So we've got all this latitude to play around with composition, but and watch the light, you know. I mean, I try to be very careful. I like front lit, side lit, sometimes back lit, but I pay attention to where the light is and how I can use it and think about the image before I click the shutter if I've got time. If it's an action shot, I don't have time, I shoot away. I mean, I will do things, and Kathy will as well, oftentimes now with autofocus, and if I've got a wide enough lens and I've got a moving subject, I'll just fire away. Even if I can't get to the viewfinder fast enough to see through it, I'll have that motor running before I, you know, just to get, you get sometimes you get something you can't believe, it's so good.
Yeah, yeah. We've got Joe from Luxembourg, long ways away. He says he's a great admirer of the fantastic photographs that the Becks take. He says it's helped pass many a long, cold evening in Luxembourg. So, but he was asking about composition, but more so, He says, what might I do to practice ahead of the moment when I get that fish, as I always feel pressured to get the photos very quick and get the fish back in the water? Also, as guides take many of the photos, anything I can do, is there anything I can do to improve the quality of what they do?
Actually, yes, you can. You can talk a guide through the image. And what we often do, what I do with a guide, if I'm alone with a guide, is, and I want him to take my picture, I will actually have him get into the decision, always keeping in mind that the most important thing about this picture is the fish and its well-being. It breathes under the water, not out of the water. So I'll literally set the camera up, set the image up with the guide in it, holding the fish underneath the water, shoot a shot, make sure my light's right, I like, make sure the composition looks good, and then we'll trade places, keeping the fish in the net, hopefully. We'll always have a net around, not flopping around on the bank, but in the water. And I do a 1-2-3. I ask him to frame it and shoot it. If I suspect he's not holding the camera right, I'll ask to see the viewfinder really quick. If not, do 1-2-3, the fish comes up, shoots the shot, and I get the fish right back in. And we do that when we're working together. There's a couple of really quick fires when that fish comes out and the fish goes back underneath the water. No photograph is worth a dead fish. I mean, we're photographing it in the first place, so we don't have to kill it and take it home and show somebody.
Right.
So, you know, taking care of the fish is, I think, the most important to us. I know that some people cringe when you handle a fish. I can tell you that years ago, Doug Swisher and I used to do schools together. I think some people will recognize his name. And we had a pond that we stocked with 50 fish. And we caught and released those fish through a whole season and photographed those fish with clients and students holding them through the whole season. And our mortality rate was about 5%. And we're not sure if that was due to being caught and released so many times or if it was a photography or a predator. But you could count the fish in this pool that they were in, and they had nowhere else to go. And if they're handled properly and they have good water temperatures and you're careful with them, you'll be just fine. But I can tell you that after we release this fish, we always pay attention to where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kathy has held on to saltwater fish because we had a predator fish patrolling the flat that we were on and waited till we could scare it away, or it went away before we released the bonefish or whatever.
Right. And the salt's much different.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but, you know, previewing the shot with the guide, talking him through it, telling him to hold the camera still. You know, whenever we take a shot, we try to get everybody to lock their elbows in tight. Don't move around a lot when you're actually pressing the shutter. And I've really been pleasantly surprised with some of the photographs guides have taken for us.
Well, let's go further with that. Ryan in Edmonton wants to know what's the best way to position a fish while holding it to get the best size thickness shot possible. And then... And then let's talk about lighting. Is it best to have them backlit, side lit, front lit?
Well, you know, if it's what we call the grip and grin. That's in our industry. That's what editors call these covers where we have somebody smiling holding a big fish. That's a grip and grin.
Grin.
Truthfully, yeah, you really want light falling on them. And I'll go through this very quickly. If the angler is wearing a hat, okay, you got light falling on your angler, and he's got a ball cap on or a fishing cap on. And if it's from 10 o'clock in the morning till about 3 in the afternoon, that ball cap's going to throw a shadow on his face. So the first thing you need to do is either remove the hat or turn your flash on and go to a fill flash mode and throw some flash underneath the hat to light his face up. You want to see who it is. Have them put their sunglasses down so you don't get the flash reflecting off the sunglasses. That's really important. If you want the fish to look realistic and yet make it look a little bigger, first off, don't hold it way out so your fingers are longer than your face. I think that's an obnoxious-looking photograph. Secondly, if you hold the fish back closer to your body where you normally would hold it, if you drop the fish, and I don't care if this is on a horizontal plane or vertical, if you drop the fish, drop its head about 6 inches, you'll add about 6 inches to the length of the fish. It's an optical illusion. If you hold the fish straight across on a horizontal plane and it's 20 inches, it looks 20 inches. If you drop the head 6 inches, it's going to look 23 or 24, maybe in 25 inches. So if you look at most of our images on covers, you'll see that Kathy or whoever the angler is that's holding it, that fish is either going down a little bit or up a little bit. It's not straight across.
Interesting.
Make your fish look longer and bigger, but you won't exaggerate it by sticking it way out and, you know, with this obnoxious-looking great big hand.
That's a good tip for guides to please their clients, but, you know, more.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very, very good tip. So you prefer with the front-lighted situation?
I really do, yeah, if you're looking for that grip and grin.
And what about the flash fill? Tips on doing that or setting your
fill flash is really, really important to us. We live with it all the time because you can adjust it. On the gentleman that had the D90 or any most of these onboard flashes, if you pop the flash open and then hold that lightning, it's like a lightning bolt switch that you push, that opens your flash up. If you hold that in and turn your command dials, you'll see that you've got a fill flash mode, and you can adjust the amount of flash that the camera is going to give out. That's a huge advantage by just putting a little flash, not a lot of flash. And you'll also find as you turn those dials that you get choices between red eye reduction, a normal flash, a slow sync, which requires a tripod. But you'll have different choices. And part of all that flash photography is remembering to read your manual. You get these instruction manuals, and you know we start taking pictures on automatic and program, and away we go, and we forget that there's a lot of things this camera will do if we just learn a little bit about it. And that goes for all the point and shoots. I mean, some of these point and shoot cameras, it's amazing what they'll do for you.
Let's see. What do we got here? I think you've answered several of these questions about fish handling already, moving in and out of the water, which is great. A lot of people were concerned about that way. There probably was 6 or 8 questions just on that, so I'm glad you addressed that, Barry, because that's important to all of us. There was a question about another question about getting good underwater release shots. You talked about using housings and so forth. Is there any thing you can tell Ryan in Edmonton about getting that release shot?
Making sure the water's clean. If there's any silt or sand in the water from either you walking in it or just from the current, that you're not going to like what you see in the picture. And beware of your shadow. It's real easy to get your shadow in the picture. Mm. That comes to mind.
Now, Kathy, do you, the cameras you're using with housings, are you just kind of sticking it under with a wide lens and
yes.
kind of blindly shooting? Is that,
you're
not sticking your head under the water or you don't have a...
No, we're trying to find our field of focus and we're working with that and we're constantly pulling up the camera and looking to see what we've got.
So that helps, yeah. That's better than the old film days when you had to wait for 3 days to find out. Right?
Yeah, and when you're if you've got somebody to help you, it's nice to leave the hook in the fish's mouth, and with the leader, the photographer can hold the camera and not move. That way, he's not kicking up any dust. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of stand, the second person can kind of stand behind him and just lead the fish around in a circle coming in front of the camera, just very much like you might lead a dog on a leash. And you can bring him around in front of the camera a couple times and just keep shooting before you release it.
Now, you're just using natural light generally for those shots too?
Yes.
Not a flash fill or anything?
No. Okay. Just watching for the sun and looking at the bottom of the stream or the flat and just picking, you know, what we think is going to be best.
Okay.
Basically looking for either really clean, nice gravel in a trout stream or nice, clean, white sand.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in the flats area.
Yeah, Roger, one thing Kathy said that I should have pointed out before, we never take the fly out of the mouth of a fish until we're sure we have the image.
Mm, okay.
And unless you want to take the chance, I mean, more than once somebody's pulled the fish up quick, we do 1, 2, 3, it jumps right out of their hand.
Yeah, and then lost, yeah.
So it's a really important image, you know, keeping that fly.
Good point. Well, we're out of time, but we have a couple more questions, and maybe you can kind of answer these as quickly as you can. Frank in British Columbia asked, do you know if there is a book on photography for fly fishers? If there is one, please give him the title. And I think you do know of one, don't you?
Well, we did a small handbook just as digital was coming out, and we probably need to do something again for sure with the digital thing. It was just called an Outdoor Photographer's Handbook, but it had a chapter on taking pictures of fish. And that was a Stackpole publication. It was just a small handbook. We'd like to think that fly fishing is a huge niche. Unfortunately, it's not quite as large as we think it is, so no one's really truly done a good book on it. Mm-hmm. That may come down the road, but, you know.
Yeah.
Something we haven't talked about that we probably should have, and I'll make it really quick, is this high-definition video that we have now with all these cameras, point-and-shoot, cell phones.
Yeah.
I mean, your cell phone's your camera today. And the video is the next, I won't say the next step, it's already here. But for a lot of us, I mean, Kathy's more involved with it than I am, but if your camera has it, use it, learn more about it. It's wonderful, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just another medium that we can have fun with.
Right. And then lastly, both Craig in Sacramento and Will in Pennsylvania asked about, what's it take to get involved in travel photography, and how would one get started with this and pursue it as a potential career?
Well, I wish I could tell you that you could make a really good living at it, but it's a lifestyle, not the good living, because the perks are that you get to travel. But and to be honest, the best way, first you have to establish yourself as a photographer. And we tell everyone who wants to get involved with this, start with regional publications first and try that. And get something published and never show anything but your best work. And do anything you can to keep your editors happy. And if you can, you know, get to the point where you're pretty confident that your photography is acceptable, you know, you can always go to these travel agents and talk to them. You don't have to necessarily always work with an agent. The way Kathy and I got started was with lodge owners. We traded photography for a couple of early trips, and, you know, we went. You have to do the work. You can't just fish. You've got to give them the images to make it pay for them to have you there. But that's, the easiest way to go.
Mm.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work. And I've always told people, if rejection bothers you, you know this too, Roger, from the photography business, you don't want to be in it because, you know, you're constantly rejected. You just have to, you know, keep moving forward and have faith.
Well, I remember when I, and for those that don't know it, I had a career as a commercial photographer, and I went to school for it. But, boy, walking out of that school with a student portfolio, what everybody wants to see is, show me some published work.
Yep.
And a lot of times you have to get that published work. It's just like you said, you have to do trade outs or do it for nothing or whatever, but get something that's been published, and then that proves your worth.
Absolutely. And if you can trade, if your work is good enough and you can get a lodge owner to let you shoot a brochure for them and trade for being able to fish there or be there, then that's one step that you've been published there. And if you get a local magazine, like we have the Pennsylvania Angler in Pennsylvania, get some images published in there, you just simply query them for their writer and photographer guidelines, and they'll tell you what they're looking for, and just send them some good stuff to look at, and be patient, and don't give up.
Keep trying.
Yep. It's like trying to catch a difficult fish.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we are out of time, so we need to wrap things up. We still have a ways to go here, though. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And, of course, we're going to be giving away the copy of Barry and Kathy's book, Fly Waters Near and Far, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So hang with us just a few more minutes here, folks, and we'll get to that. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show. This is, what do you think of that show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. One thing I want to just mention tonight, because it's kind of urgent to folks, is there is a bill pending in Montana now that could limit the access to what are now public rivers and streams. It's called Bill HB 309. And it creates a new definition for ditches in Montana's stream access law. It includes natural streams that have been altered by irrigation structures or irrigation return flows. This bill would classify hundreds of miles of natural stream channels as ditches. Hundreds of natural stream and river channels in the state have long been used by irrigators, though these channels have been hydraulically or otherwise modified for irrigation, they still are natural and have supported angling and legal access for recreation for generations. This means that some of the following waters could become deemed ditches and off limits to fishing. Upper Clark Fork River, Bitterroot River, Yellowstone River, Beaverhead River, Big Hole River, Gallatin River, Flint Creek, and most streams and rivers located in irrigated valleys. For those of you that fish Montana, this is a big deal. See if you can help the people out in Montana stop this bill and preserve your right to fish these incredible waters. You can do that by going to askaboutflyfishing.com, just our address, askaboutflyfishing.com/HB309. Okay, askaboutflyfishing.com/HB309, and that will take you to a TU site where it talks about these issues and gives you some options to contact your representatives to help fend this bill off. So I hope all of you will give that a try and see if you can help the people in Montana preserve our right to fish up there. Okay, so now time to give away our prizes. And the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's a little too late now, but you can do so on our next show, and maybe you'll get a chance at one of these incredible prizes. So if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and get your information so that we can get you your gift. So our first drawing is going to be for a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. It's a great organization to support. Again, fedflyfishers.org. International organization, both warm, salt, and fresh water. So take a look and get involved. Our winner for that is Ken Barr. Ken Barr in Montana. So, Ken, congratulations. If you already have a mentorship, we'll get you extended and enjoy being a member of the Federation of Fly Fishers. Our second giveaway is a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, an excellent magazine out of Calgary, Canada. And if you want to learn more about Fly Fusion magazine, you can go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Vaughn McDaniel in Colorado, Vaughn McDaniel. So congratulations, Vaughn. I know you'll enjoy this this magazine as well. Okay, so now to our kind of grand prize here, Barry and Kathy's book, Fly Waters Near and Far, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Again, their website is stackpolebooks.com. And so, Barry and Kathy, I have to ask a question here that we talked about earlier. And I'm going to make this a two-part question just to make it a little bit more difficult for folks out there. And the two-part question is, part one is, Barry talked about his go-to, we always talk about go-to flies, what's his go-to lens? And what I'm talking about is what millimeter to what millimeter. And also, the second part of that question is you have to answer, what format do Barry and Kathy like to work with best when shooting photographs to give their editors the best quality photograph? What type of file format is that? So two-part question. What is his favorite lens, and what file format do Barry and Kathy use? So, Barry and Kathy, I'm just waiting here to see how fast these people can type. They've never had a two-part question before. So a lot of times they'll try to anticipate things, right? But I figured
you threw them a curve.
I threw them a curve. Adam was close, but I don't think he got it. He said 200 to 400 with raw format. That's not what I was looking for, was it?
No, it's close.
Close. So, sorry, Adam. Let's see. How about this one? It says 18 to 200 raw.
He's got it.
He's got it. Well, that's Treg Owings in Moscow, Idaho. So, Treg, congratulations. I know you listen and have been a listener for a long time, so good for you for winning that book, and you're going to love this book. It's just beautiful. It's going to get your juices flowing and want you to go. You're going to want to go fishing in a lot of places. I think that's the idea, huh, guys?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So congratulations, Treg, on that. And Treg, send me your, either in that same text box or to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, send me your mailing address and so forth so that we can get Stackpole to send you that book out directly. And like I said, I know you're going to enjoy it. And thanks for Stackpole for providing that. Well, Barry and Kathy, hey, we really appreciate you being on the show tonight. It was a pleasure and fun to talk about for me, to talk about photography. I haven't done that in a long time. So.
Well, it was fun for us as well. And thank you all for your good questions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for being with us, and sure, we'll see you at one of the next shows down the road. So take care and safe travels.
Okay. Good night.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our next broadcast will be on February 16th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Steve Schweitzer. And our topic for the show is going to be fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. Steve Schweitzer has spent the last 10 years researching and fly fishing Rocky Mountain National Park. And he knows where to fish and how to fish it. If you're going to fly fish in the park, you're going to want to listen to this show. So we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Keeney's Fly Shop, Platte River Fly Shop, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.